Well, honestly, they're struggling right now. I mean, they're really struggling right now. You know, I mean, it hasn't been easy for these guys since they got out, you know?
Finally, Brian Howe. Let me ask Ricky Jackson. You faced death. How close did you come to death? And what were your thoughts as an innocent man about to be put to death by the state?
Well, you know, when you're sentenced to death, they give you a death date. And I was back there 2.5 years, and mine came up. And I heard a prison guard coming down the walkway, and I thought they were coming for me that because it was my day. But really, they give you this yellow piece of paper that says that you've had a stay of execution pending Ohio Supreme Court decision. And it was just you were always on edge. You know, it was just a terrible situation to be in, you know, thinking that, you know, you could be dead any day now. You know, it was just a horrible situation.
So the state almost took your life. They did take 40 years of your life. Will you be compensated?
I have no idea, ma'am. It's a long process. Mr. Howe could probably answer that question better than I could.
Well, Brian, you have 10 seconds.
Well, it is a long road. You know, certainly I think he deserves something for the 40 years that was taken from him, but that's something that we'll just have to see as things move forward.
It's amazing already $43,000 has been raised just from people who care about you, Ricky Jackson. We will continue to follow to see what the state will do. Ricky Jackson has just been released from prison after 39 years for a crime he did not commit. Longest held man who's now been exonerated. His lawyer, Brian Howe, a staff attorney with the Ohio Innocence Project. Happy holidays to you both. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Our specials this week will be Noam Chomsky for an hour and Isabel Allende. Tune in. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
Too much of nothing can make a man abuse a king. He can walk the streets and boast like most, but he won't know.
This is Ed Melnick, host of the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler, on the first Monday of every month between 2 and 4 p.m. I'd like to invite you to join me on December 1st for a very special Monday Sampler. In the second hour of the show, we'll be featuring Bob Dylan and the band, The Complete Basement Tapes. In this one-hour special, you'll hear many of the songs from the Basement Tapes, as well as insights from Dylan's biographer, Clinton Halen, producer Steve Berkowitz, and many others. Rita Houston narrates, tying the whole thing together. That's Monday, December 1st at 3 p.m., right here on the Monday Sampler.
Another man to eat fire.
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater for our monthly movie screening night. This month, KBOO proudly presents Alice's Restaurant, the film based on a song based on Arlo Guthrie's 1965 Thanksgiving Day. Alice's Restaurant will screen Wednesday, November 26th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about the film at KBOO at the Clinton series can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under the community events.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll get an update on protests across the country challenging police violence and racism, including a full report on the protests last night in Portland.
Native activists stand up to a uranium company attempting to set up mining operations in the Grand Canyon.
A homeless rights activist in Florida enters her third week on hunger strike to challenge a law that makes it illegal to feed homeless people in Fort Lauderdale.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 26, 2014. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. More than 400 people across the United States were arrested in protests against the shooting of Michael Brown that took place once again last night. In Ferguson, the increased presence of National Guard troops pacified the mood. But protesters still managed to take out their anger near Ferguson City Hall, where crowds smashed windows, threw objects at the police, and burned a police car. 45 protesters were arrested in Ferguson. Today in St. Louis, as many as 5 protesters were arrested after storming City Hall. Protesters were part of a larger demonstration that was staging a mock trial of Officer Darren Wilson. In Minneapolis, a driver drove his car through a line of protesters, injuring one woman. A man who threw fake blood on New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton during protests on Monday was charged with 9 counts of assault on an officer, 1 count for each cop who was splashed with the blood. Police identified the man as Diego Ibanez, a veteran of the Occupy Wall Street protests and an immigrant rights activist, and they set his bail at $30,000. In Oakland, protesters shut down 2 freeways and shattered windows to several businesses. 183 people were arrested overnight in protests across Los Angeles. Protesters continued in Portland last night, with 7 people arrested. 2 people with a rifle and a handgun were seen at the Portland protests as well. Portland Police Chief Mike Reese says the 2 were exercising their Second Amendment right to open carry. We'll have more on the protests that took place last night and in Portland later.
Over the last couple of days, information has emerged about the prosecuting attorney in the case of Officer Darren Wilson in Missouri that calls into question his objectivity in the case. Many news outlets have reported about Prosecutor Robert McCullough's family background, how his family was a police officer killed in the line of duty, and raised the question of whether this would unfairly bias him in the prosecution of Officer Darren Wilson. But something that has not been widely reported in the fact that Prosecutor McCullough sits on the board of an organization that has been indirectly involved in raising money for Darren Wilson's defense. The organization Backstoppers provides financial assistance to the families of police officers who have been killed in the line of duty. An online fundraising campaign selling t-shirts that read, "I support Darren Wilson," is donating half the proceeds of each shirt sold to Darren Wilson's so-called defense fund and half to Backstoppers. The Backstoppers organization has claimed that they have not received money from the group raising money for Wilson, but they have made no effort to distance themselves from the fundraiser.
At today's city council meeting in Portland, the council approved a measure that will provide a hearing for anyone who is excluded from TriMet. TriMet officers issue exclusion orders against people whom they consider to be an ongoing problem. Previously, there was no hearing and no way for the person excluded to present their side of the story. Under the new policy, the city of Portland will provide a hearing for anyone who is facing an exclusion order on TriMet.
At around 8 a.m. this morning, Portland Park Rangers responded to Waterfront Park on the report of several crows suffering seizures and flopping on the ground. Officers arrived and located several dead crows in the area. Portland Park Rangers located additional crows and are working with police. The additional dead crows were found in the area of Chapman and Lounsdale Square Parks and Lovejoy Fountain. In all, approximately 30 dead crows were found dead from unknown causes. Portland firefighters responded to assist and did not find any indication of hazardous materials in the air. Officers and firefighters checked the area and did not find anything apparent that would have caused the birds to suddenly die. The Audubon Society is responding to assist officers with these unusual incidents and will be conducting a follow-up to try and answer what happened to these birds. At this point, there is no information on why the birds died. Despite not knowing the reason for the bird's death, the city claimed that there is no apparent risk to members of the community.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a roundup of the sounds of last night's protest in Portland. The protest was in solidarity with the people of Ferguson, Missouri, calling for an end to police violence and targeting of communities of color. This will be followed by The Underground, KBOO's monthly program produced entirely by youth under 21 at 6. The theme for tonight's show is movies. And speaking of movies, tonight is KBOO's monthly movie night at the Clinton Street Theater in Southeast Portland. Tonight's film is the 1969 classic Alice's Restaurant. It begins at 7 p.m. with a suggested $7 to $10 donation and a can of food for the food bank if you're able. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is rainy with a high of 56 and an 80% chance of rain. Friday will also be rainy, but it should clear up on Saturday and Sunday. Right now there's a 0% chance of rain on Sunday and just 20% on Saturday. It will be cooler, however, with temperatures potentially dropping below freezing Saturday and Sunday nights. Today in history, on November 26, 1970, a group of Native Americans attending a Thanksgiving feast in Plymouth walked out in protest. The Indians and their supporters gathered on a hill overlooking Plymouth Rock near a statue of Massasoit, the Wampanoag leader who had greeted the Mayflower passengers 350 years earlier. The protesters spoke about their long struggle to preserve their land and culture. The fourth Thursday in November was not a day for Thanksgiving and feasting, they declared, but for grieving and fasting, as most Americans continued to observe the holiday in what had become the customary way, with football parades and family gatherings. The native people of Massachusetts began a new tradition, a national day of mourning held in lieu of Thanksgiving celebrations. The quote of the day is from Wilma Mankiller, former head of the Cherokee Nation, who said about the 1969 takeover of Alcatraz by indigenous activists, "It gave me the sense that anything was possible. It was idealistic, and the generosity of the spirit of the people proved that we could change anything. Who I am and how I governed was influenced by Alcatraz. The way I viewed dissent was totally influenced by Alcatraz. People on the desert were very strong about freedom of speech, freedom of dissent. I saw the importance of dissent in government."
It's 5:12, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
What better day than Thanksgiving to celebrate our country's food rebels? I'm talking about the fast-growing movement of small farmers, food artisans, local retailers, co-ops, community organizers, restaurateurs, environmentalists, consumers, and others, perhaps including you. This movement has spread the rich ideas of sustainability, organic, local economies, and the common good from the fringe of our food economy into the mainstream. It began as an upchuck rebellion, ordinary folks rejecting the industrialized, chemicalized, corporatized, and globalized food system. Farmers wanted a more natural connection to the good earth that they were working. Meanwhile, consumers began seeking edibles that were not saturated with pesticides, injected with antibiotics, ripened with chemicals, dosed with artificial flavorings, and otherwise tortured. These two interests began to find each other and to create an alternative way of thinking about food. Today, more than 16,000 organic farmers produce everything from wheat to meat, and organic sales top nearly $35 billion a year. Some 8,000 vibrant farmers' markets operate in practically every city and town across the land, linking farmers and food makers directly to consumers in a local, supportive economy. Also, restaurants, supermarkets, food wholesalers, and school districts are now buying foodstuffs that are produced sustainably and locally. This shift did not come from corporate or governmental powers. It percolated up from the grassroots. And it's spreading as people inform themselves, organize locally, and assert their own democratic values over those of the corporate structure. This is Jim Hightower saying, family by family, town by town, this good food movement has changed not only the market, but also the culture of food. As you, your family, and friends sit down for a good meal this Thanksgiving, celebrate this change, which is truly worthy of our thanks.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
2 weeks ago on the KBOO Evening News, we spoke with a Florida homeless rights advocate who had taken up a hunger strike to challenge the criminalization of people who feed the homeless. Now, Jillian Pym has been on hunger strike for 3 weeks and says she will continue indefinitely until the city of Fort Lauderdale changes its law preventing people from feeding the homeless. Pym is a member of a group called Food Not Bombs in Fort Lauderdale. So far, 11 Food Not Bombs members have been arrested, including a 90-year-old man, for the crime of feeding homeless people. Violators face a fine of $500 and up to 60 days in jail. Jillian spoke with Occupy Radio on KWVA today about her hunger strike.
I want to start with something that you mentioned as we're getting ready for the show, that the news reports have been blowing up about Arnold Abbott, a 90-year-old man, being arrested for feeding the homeless. Although you let me know that he hasn't actually been arrested, though several other people have. Let's clarify that for all of our listeners just to start out.
Yeah, Arnold Abbott was the first person that we know of for sure to have been cited under the sharing ban ordinance. When he was originally detained by the police was when I started my hunger strike. But he was never actually, like, handcuffed and arrested and taken to jail or anything like that. There's only been two arrests so far, and that was Nick Rye, who was arrested at a Food Not Bomb sharing, and Damian Gabriel, who was also arrested at a Food Not Bomb sharing. Nick was actually taken to jail and put in the jumpsuit and everything. Damian, because he was 17, was taken to the Fort Lauderdale Police Department and his mother was called to pick him up.
Now, why were those two arrested versus Arnold Abbott simply being cited?
The farthest that we can tell is because they refused to put down their serving utensils and stop sharing. They kept sharing when the cops said to put them down.
So they were recidivist criminals right there at the moment of arrest, is what you're saying?
That's my understanding. There was another person who was taken in handcuffs, but was only cited after he got back to the car.
Now, you refer to the ban in your area called the sharing ban. I imagine because of that title that the ban actually takes some similar ordinances around the country a step further, where in other places like Houston, they'll simply require certain food preparation standards for serving people in public. But this sounds like this is a little different in that it's about sharing food with anyone regardless of how it's prepared or who it's for. Maybe you can clarify the points of the sharing ban.
It's been a lot of it has been under the guise of public safety. There are those regulations where food has to be, you know, served at a certain temperature and what have you. But they've also taken it a step further to require us to provide porta potties, even though where we share food, there's a restroom in the library that's considered a public restroom by the mayor and says that the homeless can use it whenever they want. During library hours, because there was other ordinances, and one of them that were involved in the homeless hate laws, the sharing bin was the fifth out of five ordinances, and one of them was focused on urinating. And so he made a big point about there being restrooms at the library, which is right where we share food at. But in this new sharing bin ordinance, they are requiring us to hire porta potties and get a permit. You can only get two permits a year. We've been doing this every Friday since 2006. I mean, every week since 2006. In addition to that, you can't share food within 500 feet of somebody else's sharing spot. So we wouldn't be able to share food because, like, Arnold Abbott shares food in the same park. We can't share food within 500 feet of each other. Several other groups share food in that park. Used to, most of them have been scared off.
What's the rationale in that 500-foot limit? That doesn't really make any sense in terms of public safety and health.
The mayor's response to that has been a firm stance on spreading out the populace of homeless people so that they're not all congregated in one spot. But they have historically congregated in downtown areas, specifically in Fort Lauderdale, because that's where the hospital is, that's where the police station is, that's where the main bus terminal is, that's where the Amtrak is, that's where most of the social services are, that's where the jail is, that's where all the lawyers and bail offices are. I mean, they designed it that way.
It sounds like that is a clear violation of several of our civil liberties and many of our amendment rights. You know, to discriminate against someone because of their class, I mean, we have strict laws about sexuality, gender, and race, but to say you cannot assemble as a class of people That seems like that would be extremely unconstitutional. Is anyone challenging the constitutionality of that or other issues involved in this?
There's several legal people working on this, but I don't feel comfortable talking about that. But it's absolutely not just like a sharing food issue. It's a public spaces issue. In all of history, we've had the societal need to make a class of untouchables and tell them that they can't join in public because they're untouchable. It used to be blacks, and it used to be Jews, it used to be women, and now it's the homeless.
And Jillian, you mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you're currently on a hunger strike, and that's something that is being more and more reflected on a nationwide level, the idea that people are putting their forks down in response to these state restrictions on sharing food and feeding the hungry. Could you talk about your hunger strike?
As we were interviewing, entered day 19 of my hunger strike just a minute ago. At 1:15 was when Arnold and the two reverends were detained to be cited, and that was when I started my hunger strike. There was a 24-hour solidarity fast in which over 700 people fasted in solidarity. And a wonderful, wonderful person, Thursday Adams, has decided to join me in the hunger strike. He is on day 6, I believe, or 7.
And how are you? How are you holding up?
I am tired all the time.
Are you doing anything? A lot of times when I hear about hunger strikes, there's still maintenance work like a juice strike or something. What are you doing to keep your body from breaking down?
I'm drinking water with lemon, and in the mornings and in the evenings, I add salt.
What has been the response, if any, from the public officials about both the arrests and the citations and the continued feeding of the homeless or anyone, and also your hunger strike? What has their response been to these efforts?
Well, as far as the arrests, the mayor states still that there have no been arrests. He stated that the day after the two arrests were. And he also mentioned in a comment that not everyone has rights. That was on Channel 10. That was a local ABC station. And as far as the hunger strike, I've been getting a lot of support from, like, other people in, like, the community and around the world, but none of the officials have acknowledged it at all.
Now, I heard a rumor, and we know how rumors work, that the city council or the mayor, I'm not sure which, was recommending that they repeal the ban. Is that true, or is that just, you know?
Yeah, that was Dean Santalis, who is holding a town hall meeting on Monday to talk about the ordinances and such. He actually voted no on the second vote. He voted yes the first time the ordinance was up for vote and voted no the second time. He was the only one who voted no. But from my understanding, originally he voted no on it because it only covered parts of downtown, not all, and parts of Fort Lauderdale, not all of Fort Lauderdale. It only covers the downtown development area. But he is now completely out and says that we need to get rid of this. It's making us all look bad.
Oh, well, that is a good turn. I'm glad to hear that. That's the way that vote is going. And we're talking with Jillian Pym right now, who is on a hunger strike in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to protest the sharing ban of food and feeding the homeless and hungry. And Jillian, if you have any other thoughts you want to share with our listeners, please share them now.
Support and solidarity. That's what we're feeding on right now, is support and solidarity. Your emotions are our food for me and Thursday Adams right now.
Wonderful. Thank you.
The Havasupai tribe and conservation groups want to keep uranium mining out of the Grand Canyon, so they are fighting appeals that challenge a ban on new mining claims in the area. The appeals were filed yesterday by two mining lobbying groups. KBOO's Joanna Peterson spoke to Ted Zukoski, who is a representative in the fight against uranium mining in the canyon.
Can you give me some background about the initial ban on mining in the canyon?
In 2007-2008, there was a big spike in the price of uranium, and around 10,000 mining claims were filed north and south of Grand Canyon National Park on public lands in Arizona. And in response to what could have been this overwhelming rush to build new mines, the governor of Arizona, one of the local counties, five Indian tribes, people who are concerned about protection of aquifers and local businesses got together and asked the president to stop new mining claims in the area. And in 2009-2010, the Secretary of Interior put in place a temporary ban on new claims while he investigated whether to put in a longer-term ban. And then in 2012, Secretary Salazar issued a decision putting off limits to new mining claims 1 million acres of public lands north and south of Grand Canyon National Park. That decision was immediately challenged by a coalition of uranium industry lobbying groups. They filed challenges in the federal court in Arizona. And in September, the last of those legal issues was resolved when the court denied all of the industry's claims and upheld the mining ban to protect the spectacular resources around the Grand Canyon. And it's that ruling that these groups are now filing an appeal, taking this case to the Court of Appeals.
When I read about the Grand Canyon, I keep hearing about zombie mines. Can you explain this?
The last time there was a big uranium boom was in the 1980s, and then something happened called Chernobyl, and the bottom dropped out of the market for uranium. And at that time, there had been a number of mines that had been approved but had not been constructed. And those mines were put in mothballs till the price of uranium went up again in 2008-2009. And then those companies, which had just had these facilities on hold, you know, rose from the grave, and the mining companies attempted to restart them. And a number of conservation groups and Indian tribes have opposed those restarts based on the fact that the federal agencies have not taken into account all kinds of new information about the impacts of uranium mining in the area that have come to light since the late 1980s. And this ban would not affect all of the zombie mines. Those mines can continue to move forward because they're basically grandfathered by the withdrawal. But the withdrawal would prevent approximately 700 exploration projects, which were predicted to occur within the next 20 years.
Can you tell me some of the major arguments that industry has against the ban?
Well, the uranium industry makes one very sweeping claim, which would make it impossible for the Interior Secretary to ever again protect more than 5,000 acres at a time from new mining claims. They argue that the authority that the Interior Secretary was given by Congress is unconstitutional because it contains a legislative veto provision that the Supreme Court has for the last 30, 40 years said is illegal. And they argue that because of the presence of that provision, the Secretary is forbidden by the Constitution from making any withdrawals greater than 5,000 acres, which would greatly hamstring one of the few tools the President has to limit mining on public lands. Since 1870, public lands have simply been open to exploration and development of minerals. This is one of the few tools where the Secretary can say, hold on, we're going to take a pause here to make sure that there aren't other values out there, like wildlife, like archaeological resources, like resources that are important to Native American people, like groundwater, all of which were at issue and would have been in the Grand Canyon area, and all of which could have been damaged by a runaway uranium boom. So that constitutional issue is one issue. The other is that when the Secretary of Interior makes a decision like this, he has to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires agencies to take a hard look at environmental impacts before the action is taken, to look at alternatives, really to weigh sort of the costs and benefits of agency action. And the mining companies allege that the Secretary did not do that because he didn't properly analyze, among other things, the amount of uranium that was estimated to be in the ground and therefore the potential economic impacts of the ban.
So I understand you're working with the Havasupai tribe. So why is it so important specifically for them to avoid mining in the area?
The Aboriginal and historic homeland of the Havasupai tribe is the area around the Grand Canyon. To this day, their homeland is in the Grand Canyon, and their sole water supply for Havasu Creek is an aquifer that is threatened by the drilling that uranium miners have to do to get to the uranium, which is buried hundreds of feet underground. And if that aquifer is poisoned, their way of life and the land that they have been tied to for millennia, you know, will be closed to them. So this is about areas that are sacred to them. It's about areas where they've hunted and fished and gathered for centuries. It's about the place they still live in today that gives them their cultural identity, which is the Grand Canyon. Uranium mining threatens all that with the 300,000 truck trips that will be necessary to haul ore in the absence of the Secretary of Interior's decision and by the potential poisoning of the water supply.
So how likely do you think it is that the ban will continue to be upheld?
Well, we're very hopeful given the lower court's ruling. Of course, it's up to three people in robes in the Ninth Circuit, and we'll have to see. We you know, the Interior Department, the United States government, on whose side we worked with in the district court, we're sure is going to fight very hard again at the appellate court, because this is really one of President Obama's signature public lands protection initiatives, and we think they're going to work very hard to defend this decision.
And aside from keeping this ban in place, does your coalition have any other major goals for the canyon's future?
Right. Well, the coalition has also asked the president to declare the Grand Canyon Watershed National Monument, which would basically give permanent protection to the same million acres that have been, in which the uranium ban has been put in place, the ban on new mining claims. The Secretary of Interior's authority is limited to putting these places off limits for 20 years. The president can proclaim a monument that would basically give this area permanent protection from mining. And I know that Representative Raul Grijalva from Arizona has also introduced a bill that would in Congress that would create essentially a protected landscape for the same area. And this coalition is working to obtain a longer-term protection for this area as well. And as you pointed out, many of the members of this coalition are also fighting to stop these zombie mines as well.
I've been speaking with Ted Zukowski, who is an environmental attorney and works with Earth Justice. We've been discussing the ban on uranium mining in the Grand Canyon. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, November 26, 2014. Troops invade West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister approves settlement construction. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn various Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank, broke into homes and ransacked them and kidnapped 12 Palestinians. Local sources in Bethlehem have reported that several armored military vehicles invaded Wadi Fukin village west of Bethlehem and kidnapped 3 Palestinians. Soldiers also invaded Al-Fuwar refugee camp south of the southern West Bank city of Hebron and kidnapped 3 Palestinians after breaking into their homes and ransacking them. Also in Hebron, Israeli soldiers installed a roadblock near the Beit Hajji settlement, stopped and searched dozens of Palestinian cars while interrogating the residents and inspecting their ID cards. In occupied Jerusalem, soldiers kidnapped 4 Palestinians, including a young woman who was assaulted by the soldiers. In related news, soldiers invaded the central West Bank city of Ramallah, in addition to Al-Bira and Bitunia towns, and kidnapped 2 Palestinians. The latest violations are part of daily invasions, arrests and assaults carried out by the army against the Palestinians and their poverty in different parts of the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In other news, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has given orders for the allocation of $18.1 million in expansion funds for 300 units of Beit Il settlement illegally built near Ramallah, according to Israeli media sources. Netanyahu ordered Finance Minister Yair Lapid to allocate this money to move an Israeli army base while making room for the construction of 300 settlement units in Beit Il. Lapid has reportedly refused to do so, noting that the transfer of such large amount of money needs to come with the cabinet's vote. Additionally, Israeli Minister of Housing Yuri Ariel said that the settlement expansion project was on his desk and that he demanded Netanyahu to order Lapid to fund the relocation of the base, which the latter refused to do so. Head of the Anti-Wall and Settlement Commission, Ziad Abu Ain, stressed that this secret deal sabotages the prospect of a future Palestinian state. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 26, 2014, news roundup for the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Mawi, Hami, Gessa, Bandura.
A U.S. drone strike in northwest Pakistan killed five suspected militants today. According to a militant in the area, those killed were Pakistani fighters. The government of Pakistan condemned the drone strike, which took place ahead of an anti-Taliban offensive by the Pakistani military. The drone strikes took place one day after a UK-based human rights group called Reprieve issued a report drawing international attention to the number of innocent civilians killed in strikes. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism reports that the United States has carried 20 drone strikes so far this year in Pakistan.
This coming Monday is World AIDS Day, which is a day meant to bring attention to the continuing crisis of HIV and AIDS. In the Pacific Northwest and across the country, the disease continues to have a disproportionate impact on the African American and LGBTQ communities. On Sunday, November 30th at 6 p.m., a group of poets will share their experiences at the Ainsworth United Church of Christ at Northeast 29th and Ainsworth in Portland. And on Monday, December 1st, also at 6 p.m., Chrysalis Ministries will be presenting a film and panel discussion to try to break through some of the stigmas surrounding HIV and AIDS. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Pastor Renee Ward, the organizer of the December 1st event in Portland.
What do you see as the main issues that people need to keep focusing on in relation to HIV and AIDS?
Specifically to the African-American community, I believe there always is a tete-a-tete for, you know, morality versus the humanity aspect of looking at this as a public health issue versus a moral issue. People tend to mix the bag up, and that's really not fair to the people, many of who are heterosexual, that are impacted by this, and other innocent folks out there that indirectly and directly are impacted by it. Traditionally so, some conversations are left still, quote-unquote, in the closet, and so as a result, these conversations aren't healthy, but rather avoid it because of the fear of exposure to not only harassment, but misunderstandings and harsh words, and as well as just misinformation, and then the delivery of that information. So I've tried to come up with, for the last 25 years that I've been involved in this movement, to try to engage people creatively through the arts, through intimate conversations, one-on-one, engaging from top down and inside out all the stakeholders versus health organizations, civic, legislative, you name it. I've been in front of the folks and in my own backyard and within family and friends circles to try to engage people to come out and just have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the key takeaways that you're hoping to get out of it? Are you going to be talking about prevention or living with HIV AIDS? What do you think the focus is?
Interesting enough, even though this documentary was actually made in 2003 here in Portland and in the Seattle King County area, the stats will be alarming that they're quite similar to the 2003 census of what and how many people are being impacted and are still living with HIV/AIDS and newly diagnosed. And that information will be provided through community partners that I hope will be in attendance there, like the Oregon Health Authorities, Multnomah County, sexually transmitted disease division and other clinicians and health authorities out there and advocates. My goal for this simply is to that we have a conversation, a mixed potpourri of people from all walks of life, our children, our elders, our families, our individuals, our survivors, and those who have survived, their loved ones who are no longer with us, to have a conversation based upon what they see in this movie. It's called Who Will Speak for Me? And it's a documentary that profiles myself and three other primary individuals featured, although there are other folks throughout the documentary, but it's myself and three other persons who either have been directly or indirectly impacted by an HIV/AIDS diagnosis.
Now, you mentioned that you yourself have been personally impacted by AIDS. Do you feel that you're carrying on the legacy of your late husband in the work that you're doing?
Most definitely. Him, along with several other extended family members and friends whose voices has either been silent because of death, or silent because of fear of exposure to unsolicited hate, misunderstanding, and judgment. And I think the latter part, the judgment, is the main factor that seems to steal the voices of so many people still, who I know personally that are living right in our own communities, that are fearful. One of my peers, who is no longer with us, a celebrated artist in the area, upon discovery of her disease that she contracted from her husband, who came out of prison and his drug use and other things, unfortunately infected her. And as a result, years later, she would succumb to the disease. And she confided in me and was very concerned about how people would look at her and view her. And it was really sad to see that she lived under this cloud of fear. And in her latter stages, when people began to discover, and even then in new relationships she had formed, that it was still the fear of being openly and honest within the immediate family circle. But eventually it did come out. And unfortunately, there were still people who were quite, you know, mean-spirited and ignorant, both in her pre- and post-death. That was unfortunate. But I remember the last time we had that conversation, we were at another peer's funeral. And as I gave her a ride home, I didn't realize that would be the last time I'd see her. But how she thanked me for keeping her confidence and thanked me for our friendship. And that meant the world to me that I could make a difference like that. And I'm hoping that when we talk about outcomes, this particular documentary will prick the hearts of those who have sort of been steel on speaking out. And when I say speaking out, not against so much others, but speaking out to advocate for others and helping them to get the help they need, because I believe there are a lot of silent screams out there, a lot of silent voices that still need to be heard within their family, immediate family, their work, everywhere that's possible, because that's where the disease goes, everywhere possible.
Wow. And again, that event is this coming Monday, December 1st, in observance of World AIDS Day. It's Chrysalis Ministries in association with other community partners. The event is I Speak Life, and it includes a showing of the film Who Will Speak for Me that features Pastor Renee Ward and others, and a panel discussion that will be at 7:15. This event is free, and it will be from 6 to 9 p.m. at the United Way Building, 619 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland, between Alder and Morrison, on Monday, December 1st. Pastor Renee Ward, this is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Paul Rowland, Joanna Peterson, and myself, Eric Tegadoff. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. or look for us on Twitter at KBU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local numbers for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! Spends the hour with the renowned linguist and author Noam Chomsky. At 8, it's a special edition of Indigenous Voices on a Colonial Holiday. Programs include a conversation with a local activist and founding member of Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, Jacqueline Keeler. We will also hear the voices of Dr. David Lewis and Dr. Michael Yellowbird. We'll talk about history, politics, education, food, and how to decolonize Thanksgiving. KBOO thanks you, listeners and members, for listening and supporting KBOO Radio and keeping us strong for over 46 years. And stay tuned now for a roundup of the protest in Portland last night in solidarity with the people of Ferguson.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Baki Coles, and I go to Jefferson High School. I am from Southern California. I moved out here yesterday as a sophomore. I'm a junior now. I am the president of the